What is up, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. In today's episode of the Big Ideas in App Architecture podcast, we speak to Joshua Prisman, who is the chief architect at Index Exchange, the company that is enabling the evolution of ad tech. In this episode, Josh and I get into how his team is building and architecting to solve complex problems at Index Exchange and for their users. We also get into Josh's 17-year experience working as the chief architect at FICO, and we talk about some of the work that he has done supporting the decision management platform that you and I experience on a day-to-day basis. It's an episode that is filled with golden nuggets and great ideas from one of the best chief architects that I have spoken to in my experience. So pump up that volume and get ready for a great conversation with Joshua Prisman. Welcome to the Big Ideas in App Architecture podcast. Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. Yourself?
I'm doing all right. It's like a scramble, as I was saying earlier, right? Like Monday, you kind of have to go through a bunch of things that you thought you will do on Monday morning, and then you realize that you left too much on a Friday. So that kind of thing. How about you?
Oh, I have a conference that I'm going to be speaking at later on this week. So I'm trying to get everything done before getting up incredibly early on Wednesday to start the travel and the prep for that. So it's going to be a busy week for me.
When I was talking to Josh before, I was super excited with his background. And just for everyone, Josh has been a chief architect for about a decade plus, in my opinion, right? And when I went through your LinkedIn, I saw you've worked at FICO about 17 years as a chief architect, working across multiple different projects. You worked on, you know, their demand or decision-making platform, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, decision management platform.
Management platform. There you go. You did work on the AI ML side of things as things were innovating. And then you've also now the chief architect working at Index Exchange, which is an ad tech business. And I had no idea how that business worked until I had to start researching about it. So we want to get into all of that today. So as we just begin, tell us a little bit about your FICO experience and how did all of that start actually?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, FICO more or less started for me in high school. And amazingly enough, it was because of the internet. I came up through the Boulder Valley School District, and the Boulder Valley School District was one of the very first school districts that was on the internet. And as part of that, they actually had a group of students who got together and sort of were system admins, very early system admins for all of the other students on there, because a lot of the teachers didn't yet understand the technology. And that connection was provided by the Colorado Internet Co-op, which is one of the very first internet exchanges in the US. And a company called Exor, way back when, was actually responsible for maintaining the Colorado Internet Co-op. And I ended up eventually going and working for them. Then basically the dot-com stuff started spinning up and that company started doing more work inside of the marketing space. Then the dot-com crash occurred and the company very quickly, sort of like a lot of other dot-com companies, started to have to challenge and change their business model. Eventually, we were acquired by a company called FICO, which I think a lot of people in the United States will be very familiar with them because of the FICO score, which is a score that basically predicts your credit worthiness. But it also is, you know, a company that was involved in like fraud detection for credit cards. It was involved in figuring out credit line increases. It was responsible for doing targeted advertising as well, which is kind of how I ended up coming into the ad tech space a little bit, although that was a little bit more sort of personalized one-to-one marketing. And then eventually, inside of that marketing space, we built this idea of a platform. We built the ability to really make the best offer, the best next offer for a consumer based off of what we knew about that consumer, so that we were giving them more and more relevant offers. And that was pretty successful. One day I was kind of sitting down. I had a conversation with the CTO of the company and said, hey, you were really successful in building a platform for marketing. Why don't you come build a platform for financial services for everything else that we did? And so the decision management platform was really an effort to build a platform that would allow people to build analytics and decisioning into their own products in a self-service way. And it's sort of the foundation of what FICO eventually built out in terms of their decision science capabilities.
Right. So one of the most interesting things is, like, I have obviously, since I moved to America, I've been very conscious about my FICO score because I don't, and that's what I knew of. I knew about the company. When you started FICO, was it this established? Was it like still a small shop? Because credit cards, I think, were still there, but the whole process was different, right, from where it is today.
So when you think about what the credit score actually is, the credit score was an attempt to democratize access to credit. So what that enabled people to do is basically show that by paying their bills on time, being good with their money, et cetera, they deserved credit and not necessarily just because of who they knew, what color their skin was, where they lived, all of those factors. And, you know, frankly, it's been out there since the 70s, right? And so this is not new. It's probably the most important model that affects your lives, and not a lot of people always know about it. And from that point of view, it's really important.
It's very difficult for us to kind of understand, like, society really did not have these algorithms. And when you started saying, point around, this is the most significant algorithm that I get used to, more than my Netflix algorithm, you know, it's pretty, pretty true, because pretty much everything that I do on a day-to-day basis, I am using some sort of a FICO score or Equifax has scored. That all of these scores kind of determine how I kind of live and base my life upon. So going into this, like when you started your career working at FICO, did you know about all of this, or was this like an education that you kind of got once you got into the company?
Oh no, it was an absolute education. And the reality of it is that all of us kind of interface with these systems in our day-to-day lives, and we don't always necessarily understand them. And so learning about them has been sort of really fundamental in terms of us becoming better citizens in a real way, understanding how these different systems interact with our lives. In many ways, it's the exact same discussion that we're having today about AI and ML.
Yeah.
When you're starting to talk about sort of the, what does it mean for us to live in a world with these large language models that are giving us, you know, answers back to our questions, and all of the ethical considerations that come with the ability to do stable diffusion and deepfakes. So that education journey, I feel like maybe I was one of the first people along those education journey, but I'm certainly not the last. I think in general, technology literacy and how these models work is becoming more and more important.
Right. So let's expand that a little bit. I would love to, like, before we go to Index Exchange, learn a little bit about how did you guys use AI and ML? Obviously, initially at FICO, obviously you have a lot of data. You're using that, probably running regressions or, you know, classification models, or it's a gradient boost and a bunch of things that you did at the time. Could you expand on that a little bit, and without giving us a secret sauce of what you did, but kind of tell us a little bit more?
Yeah. And the reality of it is it never was just one thing. I mean, you start with the standard scorecard model. That's obviously at the basis of the FICO score, originally at least, but you're always adding more capabilities. You're always adding more insights into the model. In some cases, you're adding more data to the models that create stronger and stronger signals. And so a lot of what FICO did was to bring tools that allowed for greater and greater use of data in order to drive insights that were actually meaningful. So when you think about the credit score, that started with a scorecard, but then you start thinking about fraud detection, and then you start getting into outlier models, and then you start thinking about all the different techniques. And the reality of it is it's not just the strength of the technique. It's also, for example, some of the underlying characteristics of it. So a good example here is, you know, we started taking a look at deeper neural networks and things like that. And the question then becomes, okay, how do you balance some neural network technologies with the ability to be explainable, right? How do you balance some of these technologies with the need to protect in certain circumstances against abuse? How do you deal with adversarial networks, things like that as well? And so it isn't just that, oh, there was some new technique and that new technique opened a door. It was, there's a whole variety of different techniques that data scientists can use. Our job was really putting more of those tools into the hands of not only our own data scientists, but data scientists and business users across the world.
Right. And what kind of technologies were you guys using? I mean, obviously FICO had so much data, obviously, but, you know, 2007, 2008, once you got in, there was also the birth of the cloud and a bunch of other things were going on over there. So how did that enable, obviously data growth was a part of it. We started becoming more digitally informed. People started making more transactions online. How did that affect the kind of systems you were building?
So the real challenge there really wasn't data in many ways, because frankly, a lot of what we were doing was putting tools into our customers' hands, and they had the data sets inside of there. So for example, the FICO score, FICO is responsible for developing the score, but the actual score is run not by us, but by other credit bureaus. It wasn't run by us, but by credit bureaus and whatnot. But in a lot of cases, what we really wanted to do is, again, sort of putting the power of analytics into everybody's hands. We really were focused on things things that you wouldn't immediately think about in terms of decision science. It was things like containerization. It was things like leveraging cloud earlier on. It was things like serverless functions later. We were one of the very first big adopters of OpenShift back before it went to Kubernetes. We were one of the first big adopters of Kubernetes. We were one of the first big adopters of EKS, all of these different technologies, wow, because what they allowed us to do was actually build this cloud platform for supporting everybody in terms of what they were trying to do with their own decisioning processes.
Right. And so as a chief architect working, and you're going through change, obviously, how did you go about understanding what solution makes sense for what kind of use cases for you?
So it all begins with exactly that. It begins with the use cases. It begins with, from a product perspective, what are we trying to do? Anyone who kind of starts with the technology first, you know, might be missing something. If you're starting with technology from the point of view of, hey, what new thing does this fundamentally enable me to do that I've never done before? Then I think it's a really interesting effort. But if it starts with, okay, I've got this database, and this server platform, I'm going to go do X, Y, and Z, that's typically cart before the horse. So what we really want to find out is, what is sort of the core use cases? In our case, the core use case that we wanted to enable is we wanted to take power and put it directly in the hands of business users. And to do that, what we really did is we said, okay, is there a world in which, for example, we could build a rules engine that you could provision and write your own rules without having to have a human in the loop? Is there a world where somebody could upload a model and have that model execute against their data set that they own, not us and our data set, and make it so that they could drive insights out of it? Is there a world where we could sort of capture the outputs of various decisions in a way that it was immediately available via reporting without having to go through all of the steps that were typically involved in sort of an analytics and data process? So that's really what we kind of focused on in terms of technology enablement.
17 years working at a company, obviously you've done a bunch of things. Before we jump into Index Exchange, I'm really curious, what was your favorite project to work at FICO? Like something that you're like, this project really gave me an insane amount of experience and love for technology.
There were a lot of sort of just incredibly cool projects, a lot of incredibly cool people. Interestingly enough, I'm going to go back a little bit before the decisioning platform days to kind of answer this specific question. We did a project for Chase Bank and the U.S. Navy, where we put on board clustered computer systems on board Navy ships to do online banking, because ships go out to sea for long periods of time. Right. You actually still need to be able to do banking on ships at sea. And so what does it mean to take that kind of aspect of something that's built into our cultural fabric that we're so used to and actually make a standalone server that you could shove onto a ship and support all of the people at sea so that they could continue to have a financial system to support the functions of the ship and whatnot when it was at sea? That was kind of a really incredible project. I think it's still one of my favorite projects that I did in my career.
You still have a server, but it's not on the cloud, but it's still working. And it serves pretty much all the transactions and does all these things that you have to do. Wow.
Yep. And this was a long time ago. I mean, this was like early 2000s. So, you know, I haven't kept up to date to see what the latest capabilities are. But when an aircraft carrier goes to sea, there's 1,000 people, right, that you have to support. And so you have a whole ecosystem. You have a whole set of financial transactions you need to support when they come into port. You have a whole bunch of different things that you need to do in terms of being able to buy something at a store, more or less, on board ship while you're out at sea. How do you support those different types of use cases? All of these systems, we take them for granted in sort of our daily lives, right? We're used to being able to go to Amazon and order something. We're used to being able to stop by the ATM or stop by any place and just swipe our credit card. And that's relatively new. That's relatively modern. So what are the systems that actually kind of fundamentally enable that behind the scenes? That's an interesting question.
Very cool. I mean, that's awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that. Like, let's just switch into something that I was really curious to know about. Like, having worked 17 years at a company and done some incredible work and work that is influential to, you know, people like me and even you who's using all of this, right? Like, what inspired you to transition from working at FICO and then taking this new role as a chief architect at Index Exchange?
So there's a set of fundamentals to architecture that I think are pretty universal no matter where you go to, but your ability to use them differs, right? So when you're thinking about something in the financial services world, you're living inside of one environment where you have corporations that are used to moving at a particular speed. You have development practices that have grown up with an incredible amount of maturity over a long period of time. You have a certain volume of data that you want to deal with. As I was working at FICO, one of the things that I really wanted to exercise as a muscle that I didn't get a chance to exercise is really the scale muscle. I wanted to be able to build really complex systems that were capable of executing at a much larger scale than some of the things that we already were doing. And so I'm not talking about, you know, hundreds of transactions a second. I'm talking, what do you have to do to handle trillions of transactions? What do you have to do to get up to that next level of scale? So that was one piece. The second piece is I really wanted to kind of focus on looking at engineering cultures that were really dedicated to excellence. That was something that I had at FICO that I really appreciated. And as I was kind of looking for the next thing, I really wanted to find a place that was really focused around just having a real sense of craftsmanship and what they were doing. And combining those two things, just an incredible craftsmanship and what they're building, plus and scale, gives you the opportunity to take a business and really ramp it up to the next level. And that was the exact combination that I was looking for. And that's, I think, what I found very much at Index Exchange.
That's amazing. So for people who are less familiar with Index Exchange, you know, how would you describe what Index Exchange does and how it distinguishes itself in this competitive landscape, right? Obviously, one of the things that I know about ads is I know about Google has their ad solutions. You know, there are certain competitors in that space. Are those competitors like Google Ad Manager your competitors as well? So how would you describe it for everyone else?
Index Exchange is a global advertising exchange or a marketplace. Index Exchange represents the sell side. So, and we're connected to the buy side. And we work for basically publishers who might have web pages, applications, podcasts, videos, feed, and we make it possible for them to connect to people who are looking to buy specific advertisements and place those on it. We do this on demand. We do this connection when a page is being rendered or when a podcast is being played or when a video feed is going on. And we take care of everything from detecting and fighting ad fraud to making sure that ads might be appropriate to making sure that you can deal with the scale of it. All of those sort of behind the scenes challenges and many more. We do that as a service as we're connecting the front end to the back end.
Right.
And this model is really kind of critical to the open internet. It allows for publishers to monetize themselves without having to necessarily operate at the same scale as some of the biggest players, whether that's the same scale in terms of being able to handle all that traffic, or whether that's the same scale as having all of the commercial relationships. It basically opens up the marketplace and allows more people to get involved in that transaction.
Tell me, what is the challenge? You know, obviously, it seems like if you have to run real-time auctions on this real-time experience that you are creating for your ad tech business, for these companies, what are the different challenges that you feel that you're encountering and trying to solve?
First and foremost, volume, right? There's an incredible amount of just monetization that happens on the internet via these ads. And it is just a profound amount of transactions coming in. And in those circumstances, you have to process those transactions in a very, very low amount of time. There's emerging technologies and platforms, right? We're seeing more of a transition towards video, for example. There's ad quality and user experience, right? Nobody wants to go to a page that's nothing but a whole bunch of advertisements. There's fragmentation and complexity. So not only is there the things that the industry is currently doing, there's all of the new capabilities coming in. And oh, by the way, there's also things like privacy sandbox, where we're talking about changing a fundamental underpinning of how this has worked in the past. Then there's sustainability pieces. There's an incredible amount of compute. Compute takes power. Power has an impact, both in terms of, you know, monetary costs, but also things like global warming. All of these things are things that we have to kind of take into account and as we're architecting solutions inside of this space. And oh, by the way, you also need to do all of this in a way that is consistent with the environment that you're running in, which includes regulation. It includes just doing the right things by consumers as well. So those are kind of the challenges that, you know, keep me up at night and sort of factor into this particular problem space.
Tell me a little bit about the first one that you said, the idea of the transaction and the volume of data that you have to handle to kind of build this experience. How did you go about architecting that? Obviously, there were certain things already probably placed as a foundation before you came. And how is the infrastructure and the, I would say, the solution itself for you to handle this volume?
One of the things that really attracted me to Index Exchange was they have an incredible set of architects already there. And one of the things that they'd recently done was a full re-architecture of the platform. And when they were re-architecting the platform, they were taking many, many decades of experience and sort of writing a new system to support all of the different pieces that we wanted to do in the future as a company itself. And so that sort of re-architecture sort of laid the foundation for all of the things that we're doing now. But how do we kind of support and build on that? Well, from my perspective, it really starts with establishing sort of technical roadmaps for each of these individual areas. And so we have a technical roadmap for what we want to do on the exchange. We have a technical roadmap for what we want to do in performance. We have a technical roadmap for what we want to do in managing our operational databases. Establishing sort of those roadmaps as North Stars or where we're going to go next allows us to have kind of the conversation earlier on about what do we need to do from an architecture point of view in order to support where we as a corporation and as an industry eventually want to go to. That makes it so that when we start to think about year down the line, when we're thinking about what's the next set of challenges, hopefully we've started to anticipate that or put in sort of the general direction we're going in so that when we get into these use cases, we've got the foundation in place and we can build them aggressively. The second piece is really, we want to build a sense of craftsmanship across the board, because by doing that, what we're enabling is the ability to move faster in the future. If we take care of building it right now, not skipping the things that aren't necessarily the things that you always think about first, thinking about, you know, how do we build quality in upfront? How do we build in operations upfront? How do we build in all of these cross-cutting concerns before we get into the individual systems? When we get to the point where we have to operate at scale, and scale can mean two different things here. It can mean the scale of the transaction volumes and the latency that you've got, but it can also mean scale in terms of the number of features that we're turning out and whatnot. Having those foundations in place make that faster and faster. And so that's another key thing that we're trying to do from an architecture perspective.
Oh, that's brilliant to know. You talked about the re-architecture, you know, so I'm guessing, are you guys running on the cloud? And did you have to make decisions? Because obviously you run this solution globally. So you have to run it across multiple regions and you have to consider latency experiences for your users. Tell me a little bit about how that went about.
Yeah. So whenever it comes down to any sort of how do you deploy something, you get really driven by what your business requirements are. So a lot of people will bring up the Netflix example and say, oh, well, Netflix went onto the cloud and look at how good it is. Well, that's not exactly true. Netflix built a system that allowed them to go out and put data feeds as close to the consumer as humanly possible. That's not necessarily running in the cloud. Sometimes it may be, sometimes it may not be, right? But what they really focused on is how do we do whatever we need to do in a way that makes the most sense for the problem that they're currently looking at.
Right.
I think we very much take a similar thing. We are running in some cases on our own metal. What we're really focused on is how do we meet our customers' needs the most effective way? And then how do we do it in the most efficient possible manner, right? At the end of the day, we are an efficiency company, right? We are in the middle of these transactions connecting supply and demand. We have to do that providing the most value at the least cost possible because we have to take those savings and pass them on to our customers. And so it's really not about having a dogmatic point of view about where you're running. It's really much more about how can we best meet the needs for our customers. And in some cases, that's also cloud. You know, it's like if I'm sitting down and I'm doing some sort of task that's better suited for the cloud, we have no problems going to the cloud for those types of problems. But it is not a one-size-fits-all solution.
You talked about database operations and you're talking about these scales and transactions and volume. And this can be sometimes people scrolling and things like that. A lot of data moving around. On the database side of things, what kind of databases do you use? You don't have to give us exacts, but what are your favorite databases to use?
It's a very loaded question. And there's so much religious wars around all of it. So do you want to standardize on a single set of databases? That makes a lot of sense from an operations point of view, because supporting fragmented databases gets really expensive. Sometimes there's database technologies that can do something that other technologies simply can't do. So, you know, certainly the columnar versus row thing is, you know, a key technical differentiator. And I've over my career, I have been an early adopter of many databases trying to chase specific advantages. Again, it falls back into the what does your use case ultimately require? Because if your use case ultimately requires you to do something that's not easily accessible, sometimes you have to look for different database options. More and more, I'm convinced that it's not really the database that matters as much as what is the architecture around the database, and the database is just part of it. So if you're dealing with a heavy microservices environment, then it really doesn't matter necessarily as much which databases you're using, as long as you keep your data model segregated, because it allows you to choose the best database for the technology without having some of the operational overheads or some of the complexity overheads or the accidental complexity overheads more specifically, because of the fact that you've got the database scoped to something narrow. On the other hand, if you're using maybe a more traditional sort of data warehousing based approach, you've got to be really careful about your database, because you're shoving everything into the same database and you're building in a single point of failure for your entire company. And so a lot of it, you know, really depends on what it is that you're trying to do at the end of the day.
Curiously, you know, I've been thinking a lot about GDPR and this whole idea of data security, data privacy. And okay, let's say in the context of GenAI, a lot of people are saying, hey, I don't want my data to be trained for, you know, all of this. I don't want the model to learn how I'm getting used. Obviously, that's the thread from which this drove, but it also applies to what you guys do at Index Exchange, because you have to kind of, when you design your solution, to consider data privacy and data regulation. So how has this impacted how you make decisions around architecture when you're building this product out at Index Exchange?
One of the things that I like telling everyone is that architecture is not just about lines of code, right? Just like software development, software engineering is not just about lines of code. It's about everything else. When you architect, you don't just architect for how do I make system A talk to system B. You have to architect it for the environment in which you're operating in. And when I say environment in which you are operating in, that doesn't just mean the servers you're running in. It also means what's the regulatory environment that you're dealing with.
Right.
What is the cultural environment that you're running in? What do you consider ethical, right? Are you making sure that you stay within those bounds of what it is that you're actually trying to do? So GDPR is a good example. There's a couple of different ways that you can approach GDPR, one of which is you can just kind of throw a slapdash process on top of it and say, okay, that's enough for what I'm actually trying to do.
Right.
Or you can really think about what are we trying to do with GDPR? What are sort of the core principles of GDPR? And then what are the core principles of things like secure by design, private by design, all of those things? And how do we really internalize that into the fundamental architecture that we're trying to do? And I firmly believe that as architects, you have to take that second point of view. You have to take the point of view of this is my operating environment, and architecting for that is just as important as architecting a decision about which database you use or what language you're using or what your web services ultimately are.
What are the pitfalls then? Like, I know I have had experiences where we design for everything and then we start thinking, oh, we had to think about GDPR. So what are some of the pitfalls around not looking at the right things when you're designing that?
Specifically, what I would say is there's an idea of intentional design and an idea of emergent design. Those trade-offs, more often than not, have to do with sort of what I would say a misbalance between intentionality and emergent is. Most of the time when you're making architecture decisions, you actually want to be making the architecture decision at the point in time in which you actually need it. And it should be made it by the people who are actually implementing it or the business users that are actually closest to that decision. But the reality of it is sometimes you need long-term direction and you need to align that short-term decision into a long-term direction. And that's really where intentionality comes in. And so typically what I would say is when you see that problem, it's because somebody said, okay, we need to support this, and therefore we're going to re-architect every single decision because of this one thing. In reality, I think what you do is you say, we're going to make an architecture decision that we're going to support privacy by design, whatever. And then you basically set that long-term direction, and then you allow the decisions as they're coming out to be made, but you make sure that those decisions are consistent with what your long-term vision is. And that way you're not necessarily wasting effort, or designing castles in the sky is the other way I like to put it, or ivory tower architecture is another way to put it. But on the other hand, you've laid enough of a foundation on there so that when you are building the towers and the buildings and everything else that you need, that you have a structure that allows you to move forward with that.
I wanted to go back to a thread that you were kind of mentioning about the volume. Your systems have to be available all the time, because the real-time auctions are happening. You have to make decisions, and your users have to make, or customers have to make decisions. So how do you design for scalability and resilience in your architecture? Like, what kind of decisions go into kind of manage the high volumes as well as the velocity of your programmable ad transactions?
I was one of the very first big believers, loud believers, in containers and microservices. And the reason I was a big believer in those was because they gave us the ability to have independent failure domains and independent deployment domains.
Right.
So for what we were trying to do, which was really focused around self-service, empowering the business user, all of those things, that made perfect sense, because it gave us a way in which we could isolate resources, protect those resources, have a full life cycle for those resources, et cetera. So the microservices model made sense. Does that model necessarily make sense in every use case? No, it may not make sense to have something with 50 different microservices if you're out having to handle a real-time card swap or a real-time auction scenario. You want to look for different architecture patterns. And so the way that you tackle these problems is really by understanding what it is that you're trying to accomplish, and then letting the data, in this case, what the requirements are, drive your decision, i.e. which architectural patterns that you use. And then it starts to become a little bit more sane. You say, okay, if I need to hit this, then, and I need to have these kind of failure characteristics, it becomes easier to say, okay, where's my load balancers? You know, am I using a microservices architecture? Am I doing X, Y, or Z? Am I using Python for my backend? All of those type of decisions can get scaled out based off of sort of your core principles, but you better know what your core principles and your core use cases are.
Every time I get someone on the podcast, I'm selfishly so excited to just learn how they kind of look at problems. And it's so amazing as to, with your experience in the space, how easy it is for you to kind of break down something so easily. So it's just natural for you now. And it's amazing. Yeah.
It's not always easy, but it scar tissue helps with this particular area. I'll put it that way. That's kind of another thing, though. With every decision you get right, you're going to get X many decisions wrong, right?
Right.
And so the other thing that I would say is, you know, with all of this is collect data, learn what's working, learn what's not working, and pivot quickly when you need to. Failing cheaply is an asset at the end of the day. And I've failed plenty. It's figuring out how to...
I mean, I would be surprised to meet a chief architect who doesn't say, well, I built something and was part of something that did not fail at all. You know, you won't have that. But I think what you made the point around executing with speed as well as failing cheaply is such an undervalued thought, you know, because you spend hours and days and weeks and months into something, and then you realize, this is not the direction we want to go. So it's so critical. So I want to jump into that. How do you help make that decision at Index Exchange or in your real life, you know? Like, do you have a principle? Like, we'll look at this for 2 weeks or 1 month, and then we'll scrape this or we'll go in this direction. How do you make that happen?
The principle of it is build your safety net, right? Build the things that are absolutely key to you being able to run your business, right? Do you have observability in place? Do you have quality in place? Build a checklist, right? Come up with the things that are absolutely critical, but then put in place kind of a life cycle that allows people to experiment quickly, right? Start out by encouraging them to go do quick experiments of not only sort of technical things, but maybe also business things. Hey, what happens if we provide this feature to a customer? Do they pick it up? Those type of things.
Yeah.
Then have a solid plan on how to take your learnings from those discovery phase things and throw everything else away, because you don't want that stuff, and start to build your software. This is also part of the scaling thing, right?
Right.
Take the learnings you've retired as much risk as you possibly can. Build out your first set of services. Don't try and solve every single problem at the very first moment. Don't try and build a Taj Mahal up front. But figure out what the shack in the corner you need to build is and start building that piece. Be intentional about the decisions that you're making, right? Do a review process, however you want to go after it. We use architecture decision records, ADR processes, things like that. But do it in a very iterative fashion. And then as you start to get to the point where you've got critical mass, start thinking about what do I need to do to mature this? What do I need to do to make it so that it is a system that I'm not worried about in production? What do I need to do to make it so that it will scale further and further as I get the base pieces in line? And I think that that core business philosophy, right? Try something, see if you've got market fit, pivot if you don't. That entire mentality is not just a business concept. It can very much be an architecture concept as well, and should be an architecture concept in what you're working on.
So you spoke about some of the things around, you know, mentoring and what your guidance is for architects and engineers. You know, what are some other things that you can kind of share right now that foster leadership and innovation for people who are listening?
I think a big thing is finding the champions, the people who are really going to drive excellence at your company, at your nonprofit, in your community, and really doing everything you can to empower those people. One personal thing that I have is just trying to make sure that we are getting as much diversity, both in terms of people of different ethnicities, but also diversity of thought as possible, right, into those decision-making processes as possible, because that type of engagement really encourages an environment where people can challenge ideas, where people can come in and say, hey, I saw you want to do it this way, but if you also did it this, this, and this, you could achieve something much greater. Software engineering is like the ultimate example of 1 + 1 = 10. The parts that you put into it aren't lines of code. The parts that you put into software engineering are processes and decisions and people and passion. And whatever you can do to kind of encourage that, the better off the product that you're going to get at the end ultimately is. And you can always go and work on your quality. You can always go and work on building a more inclusive environment. You can always go and build all of these better systems, but it's really pulling all those things together and structured decision making, and then having a passionate set of, again, I'll fall back on that term I keep using, craftsmen, to go execute it. That's really what is going to drive your success over the long run.
100%. Yeah. And so as a chief architect at Index Exchange, technology doesn't stop, right? Like, you are working on something every damn day, every damn hour, there's a new thing coming out. I've been following some of the really cool open source projects that you're supporting, like the OpenC3 project and things like that. What I'm curious about is that how do you keep up with tech trends and how do you continue to learn about what's happening? What's your formula?
So OpenC3 is a great example of a project that I love. So OpenC3 is kind of this amazing open source project that's out there for literally doing management of satellites.
Yeah, I saw that.
What I absolutely love is I love seeing people who are passionate about their projects. I love seeing people who get passionate about a specific bit of technology that they're interested in. Because when I see somebody who's passionate about something, there's a reason that they're passionate for it. And I don't always know the reason for it, but simply following their passion and what they're engaged on will so often tell me about something that I knew nothing about and open my eyes to some new technology that's coming, or some new technology trend that's coming, or some new application of technology in culture and the government that I wasn't aware of. And so looking for people who are passionate and then seeing what they're passionate and trying to get a sense for why they're passionate about it, more often than not, leads me into technology that I wasn't aware of. So that's one thing. I think another thing is Steve Jobs used to talk about the intersection of technology and humanities. Interestingly enough, I find that that's a really good way to keep track of the technologies that are really going to matter in the future. So a lot of what we're seeing now with large language models and whatnot are actually driven by some very fundamental questions about, you know, how we think, what it means for the internet to be searchable, what it means to have sort of this distributed web and things like that. So looking for new areas where you see that intersection of humanities with technology has always been important. And then the other thing is, whenever I see a technology trend, trying to figure out what the vectors in time are, i.e. if I can do this now and this tomorrow and I've got good visibility on it, what does it ultimately look like? I think that that is another sort of key piece or key enabler, if you will, for staying ahead of the technology curve. But I'll be honest, it never stops. It always gets there's always something new. Every time I've thought, okay, this space is getting into a mature space. And to some degree, right, we work in a very mature space.
Yeah.
We use Linux. Linux is derivative from Unix. Unix has been around more than 50 years. You know, the microprocessor's been around for a very long time. They are all iterative improvements on each other. What's really changing is new ways to apply those fundamental technology blocks to new problems. So every now and then I'm like, okay, you know, do I really have enough to get into this next curve of technology? But it always comes back to that same pattern.
I agree.
New technology applied to longstanding human problems.
One of the most fascinating thoughts that I've had recently is that if you take a large language model and use a quantized model and put it into your pen drive and put it on your laptop and go start living on an island today, you will still have the history of humanity without the internet on that large language model, which is fascinating, right? Like, it's like a time capsule.
It is. But then what do you do when it starts telling you that Benjamin Franklin was a fan of absolute despots and things like that too? You know, so you have to start dealing with the fact that technology can lie to you.
Exactly.
What does that ultimately mean? You know, what is the ultimate outcome of those type of curves as well? And the reality of it is with technology, I firmly believe technology is neither good nor bad, but what we do with it certainly can give it a moral character. What does it ultimately mean that we've got sort of technology and these trends, and what does that mean for the sort of the next 5 years? And that, it's a challenging set of questions.
I agree. I think the innovation curve that I have seen in the last decade, it's showing me exponential growth. So I'm really fascinated like you. And I loved your perspective around bringing the idea of humanity around what we are building and looking at it from that prism, because it shows you so many different views. All right. So I know we're close to the end. I wanted to ask this last question to you. What is the one lesson that you have learned in your career that you would like someone else to kind of know today so he doesn't make the same mistake?
Don't be afraid of failure. You know, the reality of it is you're not going to get every question right. You're not going to get every answer right. Learn from it. Take the next steps. Be aggressive. Be passionate. But also, when you made a bad decision, realize you made a bad decision and go fix it. Take ownership, be a craftsman, right, of whatever it is that you want to build. That will get you an awful, awful long way.
Well, Josh, it's been such a pleasure having you on the podcast. It's been such an, I would say, a fascinating conversation looking into the mind of a chief architect. You know, I'm pretty sure I'm going to suggest that as the title for this podcast.
Oh, dear.
No, they'll probably come up with something better. But the question I wanted to ask you is, where can people find you? Is it LinkedIn? Do you have a Twitter? Where do you post stuff? Where can people follow Josh's activity?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. I'm Josh Prisman on Twitter. I'm also on LinkedIn. I am talking more and more about Privacy Sandbox and some of those technologies at industry events.
We'll follow you. Everybody listening in, go in, check out Josh on Twitter as well as his projects that he's working on. Fascinating thing that they are working as a company on is Index Exchange. Some really, really brilliant things. And I'm really curious about, do you also have an engineering blog or something for Index Exchange that people can read?
Yeah, so there's a couple of great resources. There's an engineering blog for Index Exchange. There's also for people trying to understand the ad tech ecosystem a little bit better. We do a series of videos called Index Explains. That's absolutely phenomenal. You'll see members of my architecture team have been doing some of those as well. Yeah.
That's where you go and learn. All right. So once again, thank you, Josh, for hopping on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you, everyone, for listening in. I'll catch you in the next one.